Отношения.
Affairs.
Схеси.
Сорга.
Affairs.
Відносини.
Стяги.
Односи.
Рішкілер.
Афари.
Інсем.
Релаціони.
Шуун.
Справи.
Hello, and welcome to the International Affairs Podcast from Chatham House. My name is Ben Horton. International Affairs is a leading academic journal covering the many disciplines of international studies. In each issue, we publish an extensive book reviews section, providing expert assessments of the latest scholarship on international studies. You're listening to the first in a new series of podcasts in which a member of the IA team interviews the author of a notable book reviewed recently in international affairs. This week, I was joined from the United Arab Emirates by Tom Fletcher, author of The Naked Diplomat. As this interview was conducted by phone, the sound quality occasionally wavers, but I hope you enjoy listening to what was a fascinating discussion. Today I'm joined by Tom Fletcher. Tom Fletcher is a diplomat and author. Having served as a foreign policy advisor to three UK prime ministers, from 2011 to 2015, he was the UK's ambassador in Lebanon. Now based in the UAE, Tom works as a visiting professor at New York University and as an advisor to the Global Business Coalition for Education, working to get millions of children across the world into schools. His new book, published in 2016 by HarperCollins, is titled The Naked Diplomat, Power and Statecraft in the Digital Age. Tom, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben. Great to join you.
So you've worked in diplomacy at a time of great upheaval, both within the UK and abroad. While your book is not a biography, and you make it clear at the start that you don't want this to be a kind of memoir, I wondered if you could give a kind of short introduction to your career and explain what the catalyst was for creating this book.
Sure, and you're right, diplomacy has been in a great time of upheaval and remains even more in a time of upheaval, actually, since I formally left it. I should say that still, when I fill out those forms at airports, I still write diplomat as my career. Yeah, the book, it definitely wasn't a memoir, partly because I hope that my career hasn't come to a complete end yet, but also because, you know, when you do those jobs, particularly in Downing Street, working very, very closely with these extraordinary characters, there is much that, as a public servant, and the clue is in the title there, that you shouldn't write down in a memoir or anywhere else. There's much which is bound by the Official Secrets Act, but there's also much that's bound by a sort of code that rightly exists, particularly in the British civil service, that ensures a level of trust between leaders, politicians, and the civil servants they work with. And so the best stories I left out, I'm afraid. Not great for book sales, but I think is the right way to go about it. The book really sort of originated during that period in Beirut when I experienced firsthand the ways in which I could suddenly connect through social media to a completely different audience, to engage a completely different set of people. And so it made me want to look at how innovation over the years had transformed the way that power works. What was it about the printing press that suddenly meant that politics shifted in that era? What was it about train travel, steam travel, planes, electricity that changed the way that governments and citizens engaged and interacted? And I was kind of building that plane as I flew it, and experimenting in particular with Twitter and blogging to reach those different audiences. And in doing that, it occurred to me through research and through talking to people that we're only at the very beginning of this process. Things are going to open up enormously. We're going to go through in the next century as much change as in the last 43 centuries, technological change. And that's going to put states out of business, businesses out of business, but also ideas out of business. And I'm really passionate about this job that we do, this craft of diplomacy. I think we need it more than ever now in the digital age. There's all sorts of issues being thrown up. Our rights online. Do we need a Geneva Convention for cybersecurity? How do we stop people being radicalized on the internet? All those issues are ripe for real, sleeves rolled up, hard pounding diplomacy. And so I care more than ever about diplomacy, and I just want us to ensure that we do it better.
So obviously you mentioned that you yourself have a sort of burgeoning presence on Twitter, and you also write this blog, The Naked Diplomat. And I wondered if you could talk to me about how you feel that's changed your role as a diplomat? Presumably when you entered the profession, these elements didn't exist, and presumably that had a knock-on effect on your sort of day-to-day activities and your approach to diplomacy. How has blogging changed that?
I think it transforms everything. And the reality is that for most industries now, that you are either digital or dead, and that's the same diplomacy. Diplomacy's always been Darwinian. It's always changed with these different innovations. For me, 20 years ago, when I started out as a diplomat, most of what we did was behind the curtain, as it has been for centuries. It was about transmitting messages confidentially between governments. It was about putting together discrete analysis for our leaders about what was going on in another country. And increasingly, that's been worn down, and that line between what we do in private and what we do in public has been eroded. To the extent that now the public has much more of an interest, quite rightly, in what we all do behind the curtain. And for us to retain the trust we need to do our jobs, we have to open up much, much more. And I mean, let me just give you one example of that with technology. Now, we would have had the means, technologically, if there had been a terrorist attack brewing in Lebanon, to have contacted by text message every Brit using a mobile phone in Lebanon at the time and warn them where not to go, where to go, and so on. But of course, the public would never have trusted us to have had some kind of system that had us hoovering up all of their mobile phones and effectively being aware of where they were at any time. And so that's one very, very practical example of where lack of trust in our profession makes it harder for us to do the most important thing we're there to do, which is to protect our citizens. And so I figured, in a way, it's where the book came from. We have to do a better job at explaining what we do to people and to win them over and help them realise that we do still have a role as diplomats in the 21st century.
Obviously, it's important to explain things to the public, to explain your role, because the trust is such an important issue. But presumably, the balance that you have to strike between building this transparent public trust and also maintaining this behind closed doors activity, is there still a place for this behind closed doors diplomacy? And is it something that diplomats today need to focus ever harder on?
There is absolutely a need for confidential diplomacy, for secret diplomacy in places. There's still a need for espionage. A lot of diplomacy has to be the last 3 feet, the human relationships that you build up. And you can only do that if the person trusts you, that you're not going to then go and tweet the whole conversation out or live blog the meeting with the minister. So huge amounts will remain behind closed doors, behind the curtain. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make a much, much bigger effort to engage people, and in particular to engage the public. For years, the language of diplomacy has been deliberately exclusive. We've almost created a kind of code or a creed around what we do, designed to keep people out. I mean, look at the average statement from any foreign ministry after a meeting of ministers. It's kind of Minister X, Minister Y discussed a range of bilateral issues and mutual concern. I mean, that stuff just doesn't cut it in a social media age. It puts people off. And so one of the things that I was trying to do in Beirut, that we tried to do in the review of the Foreign Office that I did last year with a team in London, which I think is really important for diplomacy, to open up that language and to try to speak human again and not just put a bunch of jargon and platitudes around everything that we do.
In a sense, just to take an example, the current US president gets quite a lot of criticism and at times ridicule in the media for his use of Twitter. But do you actually think he's probably closer to the right path in that regard? Or do you think it's a distraction?
So I think there's a long list of things that I would disagree with President Trump on, many of which are more important than social media, with climate change, human rights, migration, the Middle East, all very high on that list. But I think you do have a point that if the art of social media is connecting directly with people and communicating in an authentic way, then of course he does do that. I used to say to ambassadors going out to postings that the three key things about Twitter were to be authentic, engaging, and purposeful. Authentic means you've got to be yourself. People want to know the human behind the handle. Engaging is, you've got to create content that makes people lean forward, that makes them interested. And purposeful, if you're a British ambassador, it's got to add up to something. Is it making your country more secure, more prosperous? Is it promoting your country's values? You've got to tick all those boxes, I think, if you're doing it as a diplomat. I mean, obviously, Trump is not doing it as a diplomat. He's doing it as a politician. But he is authentic, whether you like it or not, it's definitely him tweeting at 3 o'clock in the morning. he's engaging, you know, we're all talking about his tweets in a way that we weren't with, say, President Obama's tweets in the same way. And there is a sort of strange sense of purpose running through it as well. Now, whether or not it makes America stronger and more secure, I think is a trickier question. There's a danger in some ways if you expose too much of what goes into the sausage that people won't want to eat the sausage.
That's a good metaphor. As the digital revolution progresses, as challenges become ever more technologically complex, do you think the background of the individuals that pursue diplomacy is going to change? Do you think diplomats are going to need different skills going forward to what they currently have or have had in the past?
I think there will be a shift slightly in the direction of finding people who are stronger communicators and maybe slightly less intellectual. That shift was already underway. The most important skills for diplomats predate the internet. They're about empathy, emotional intelligence, networking, the ability to form relationships of trust. All of that is actually much, much more important than whether you can run a kind of nifty little Twitter account. But in any case, the most important shift, but certainly in the UK, in the kind of people that make up diplomacy, is that the Foreign Office is becoming much, much more diverse. And long overdue, women are taking the top jobs. I think everyone knows that must happen even faster. And that we're seeing a diplomatic service that looks and sounds much more like Britain and much less like an elite.
It's been interesting to watch various British negotiators come out with the line that there will not be a running commentary on the Brexit negotiations. But do you think that social media and just the sheer buzz around this pretty seismic event in UK politics means that not providing a running commentary is essentially impossible? Do you think that's a kind of a fool's errand in a sense? And that what's more pressing is the need to control what that commentary is and the content of that commentary than quibble about whether or not there could be a running commentary?
So look, it's going to be much, much harder in any negotiation now to keep a lid on everything. The days when you could simply go to Vienna in 1815 and spend months locked up negotiating the future of Europe are obviously behind us. And there's intense scrutiny now on anyone going to any international meeting. But I do think you have to find a space which is not being live-tweeted by the protagonists. You have to find a way to negotiate around issues in private. And I think that will happen with Brexit. I think it actually is happening with Brexit already. It certainly happened with the Iran deal. You had Foreign Minister Zarif of Iran, who was a very deft Twitter user, but he was using it to try to shape the public debate around the deal. What he wasn't doing was live-tweeting every argument or agreement with John Kerry. So I think there is a way of doing it. And you have to be kind of grown up as well in the way that you talk to people about the negotiations and explain, look, we can't tell you simply every twist and turn because we don't yet know how the story ends. It's a negotiation. George Mitchell said that every peace process is 700 days of failure and one day of success. You know, there will be many days of failure. And we also need the media and the public to recognise that. I think the public do, actually. And not to treat everything like a kind of who won today contest.
There's a sense from some quarters in the academic world that international relations today is moving possibly more towards bilateral relationships with countries and further away from multilateral agreements. Trump withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement's an example, perhaps the decline of TPP, even the UK's decision to leave the EU. And I just wondered whether you thought that was a realistic presentation of what's happening at the moment in international relations, and also what impact that will have on the diplomatic profession.
Yes, and I think there's ebbs and flows. And I was working in Downing Street for a period which was in hindsight quite a surge in multilateral cooperation. It didn't always work. Copenhagen Climate Change Agreement wasn't a great success, but there was a sort of spirit out there that the only way to fix these problems, which are clearly cross-border, migration, disease, climate change, clearly can't be fixed within national boundaries alone. The G20, after the financial crisis in London, I think was a real high point for global cooperation. And we had great ambitions at the time about reform of the WTO, reform of the IMF. I've just done a report on how the UN can do its job more effectively using technology. So I think I wouldn't give up altogether on those systems for global cooperation, but clearly we are in a time of rising nationalism, and this is always the case after big economic downturns. The extremes tend to get louder, the center tends to get quieter, and you will have more and more people basically saying that you don't need to have a view of the world to have a world view, which is a great pity. But I do think it will swing back again, simply because of the nature of these challenges. I think one challenge we have at the moment is that the election of the US president created a vacuum for leader of the free world. And at the moment, no one has yet put their hand up and said, okay, we'll fill that space until the next president of America or someone else is ready. You know, there are some obvious candidates. Angela Merkel is someone who has the heft and the vision and the reputation. But she has obviously her own election coming up. You have some new leaders on the scene, Justin Trudeau, Emmanuel Macron, who certainly ideologically can fill that space, but are still relatively new. I personally would like to see Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, fill more of that space. I believe he has the kind of character, but also the authority of his position to speak out much more on these big global issues and really challenge the rise of nationalism. If you look at his UN Commission on Human Rights in Geneva, Prince Zayed, you know, you hear there how powerful that voice can be, how credible that voice can be. And so we need more of that at the moment to defend international cooperation, to defend the sense that we are greatest when we are outward looking and working together. And that's basically diplomacy. Diplomacy is about one of two human instincts, to collaborate and work together for resource. And what we're seeing in much of the world is the other human instinct, which is to compete over resource, to fight over it, and to blame all your problems on someone who looks or sounds slightly different or lives the other side of the ocean.
And that's all we have time for. Tom Fletcher, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to the International Affairs Podcast. For more information on international affairs and how to subscribe, please visit our website,